This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. One in eight women has trouble getting pregnant in the U.S. Today, one in 60 American babies is born through in vitro fertilization, and that figure is rising quickly. Many of you told us that fertility treatment made what seemed impossible possible.
I was so worried that I would never get pregnant that I ended up going through three IVF banking cycles and had a successful pregnancy and then got pregnant on my own, and now I have a ton of embryos.
My husband and I spent about $150,000 through fertility treatments, juggling the expense on 0% interest credit cards.
As two gay dads, having a child the normal way wasn't in our cards. We used IVF with our surrogate, got an egg donor, and we had an amazing process altogether.
We went through about 6 years of treatments to have both of our kids. I'm a touring singer-songwriter, and I had to shoot myself up in random venue bathrooms before going on stage. Anyway, we're very grateful for our family and wish anybody who's going through this so much luck.
Clearly, fertility treatment works for many people, but it often comes at a high cost, physically and financially and emotionally. And one of the highest emotional costs can come when the doctors we trust abuse their power in highly disturbing ways. That is the subject of a new podcast from WFYI Public Radio in Indianapolis called Sick. And the first episode dropped last week. Joining us now from WFYI are the co-hosts and reporters of Sick, Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper. Lauren, Jake, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
We welcome your questions and stories about this, particularly if you've had experience with fertility clinics or fertility processes. How did they go? What was the outcome? And was it what you hoped it would be? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A at WAMU.org. Lauren, season one of Sick centers around the fertility industry, particularly the case of a man named Dr. Donald Klein. This story is a little hard to hear, highly disturbing, fair warning, but it's one that we think is worth telling. First of all, just give us the basic thumbnail sketch. Who is Dr. Donald Klein?
Sure. Well, Donald Klein was a fertility specialist here in Indianapolis. He started practicing in the early 70s up through the late 2000s. And he was practicing at a time when fertility medicine looked really different than it does today. He was known for using fresh donor sperm for artificial insemination. So when women came to see him because they had trouble getting pregnant naturally, and they found out that the cause was because their husband had no sperm or a low sperm count, Klein said he could help by finding fresh donor sperm and inseminating them with that. And so then he practiced for many, many years and had a really great reputation. He ended up also being well known for an egg freezing technique, was just sort of known as a pioneer in the field. Years and years later, then, thanks to direct-to-consumer genetic testing like 23andMe and Ancestry, it came to light that he hadn't used anonymous donors. In many of the cases, he had used his own sperm to impregnate women.
Jake, in episode one, we meet Liz White, who had struggled with infertility in the 80s and became one of Dr. Klein's patients. Tell us about what happened to her. What was her experience?
Sure. So she and her husband started struggling with infertility in the late 70s, and they tried for a year on their own to get pregnant. And that's a pretty common length of time to wait and see if you can get pregnant naturally. They figured out that they couldn't. They got some testing and figured out that her husband had no sperm because of an issue when he was a child. And so she essentially she saw one doctor for a long time. I think it was about a year and a half, and she was getting frozen sperm at that time. And back then, the success rates were lower as well. She never got pregnant with frozen sperm, and so she was eventually referred to Donald Klein, the doctor who's the subject of our podcast. And she saw him for 5 months. He told her that he would find a medical resident who worked across the street who would be readily available to provide a sperm sample whenever she needed one. She remembers coming in three times a month, and then after 5 months of treatment, she did eventually get pregnant.
And just to be clear, Jake, the difference between using a fresh sperm sample as opposed to those that have been frozen is that the idea is that, correct me if I'm wrong, that a non-frozen sperm sample has a higher viability, the sperm have more motility, they're able to move more readily, and so the chances of actual insemination are supposed to be higher, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think it was especially it was more true decades ago when this technology was sort of coming about. Freezing wasn't perfected, and then eventually they, over time they've gotten much better at it.
Let's zoom out a little bit and get to a clip from your podcast. Here's Liz White talking about the experience of going through fertility treatment. She said that she did not really feel like she could talk to her friends about it or even talk to her husband about it. Here's part of Liz White in episode 1 of Sick.
I kept the privacy of having my period start and the sadness really more to myself. I really carried that. And I didn't want him to feel any worse than he felt. So the disappointment I felt, I hid from him. He knew I was going, but it wasn't like a conversation where, oh, I'm sorry, you had your period again. I did it alone.
That's Liz White in episode 1 of Sick. Some of you did share your stories about dealing with the public perception of infertility treatment. Joan tweeted, I think the hardest part about infertility is the stigma. Even in the waiting room, no one talks to each other. I finally started telling people what I was going through, which led to me having my baby, as my hairdresser offered to be my egg donor. We had countless failed IUI and IVF. Then finally, I was diagnosed with a clotting disorder. With a combination of egg donor and daily blood thinner injections, I was able to have my baby girl. Lauren, talk a bit more about public opinion of this industry and of artificial insemination in the 70s and 80s when Dr. Klein was working. As I understand it, the stigma was fairly strong.
Yeah, just like Liz said, she didn't talk to anyone about what she was going through. She didn't talk to her husband. Years later, she found out actually that her best friend was going through very similar treatment, and they didn't talk to each other about it. And just like that person wrote, it's not to say stigma has totally gone away, but now there's things like Infertility Awareness Week, which is in April, and folks are encouraged to share their stories on social media, or you'll see high-profile people come on, morning talk shows and talk about how IVF or any other assisted reproductive technology, helped them get pregnant. But yeah, back then, it just was not talked about.
And we should, but by the way, she used those two terms, IUI and IVF. IUI is intrauterine insemination and IVF in vitro fertilization. Lauren, those are two different kind of methods of fertility treatment, right?
Right, they are.
Jake, what about Liz finding out that she had been impregnated by Dr. Klein instead of an anonymous sperm donor? First of all, what did she expect? Did she expect, had she been told about who the donor would be and then was deceived, or was that just not part of the conversation?
It was part of the conversation. I mean, her understanding was, so Klein's clinic was located directly across the street from a hospital that had medical residents that were there all the time. And so what he told his patients, including Liz, was that he would essentially, ask around for donors and that he would basically gather up a group of young men who were willing to donate their sperm. On the condition of anonymity, the patients were never supposed to know who the donors were, or vice versa. And Liz remembers bringing in cash payments that were for those donors. So every time she would come in, she would bring cash, which was supposedly for the donor. And then she never, at least what she told me was that she never wanted to know who that person was. She was satisfied with anonymity, and that's generally how it worked back then. Anonymity was expected, and the doctors essentially were making the decision about who the sperm donor would be. And then eventually she found out that it was Klein. And I mean, the thing that sticks with me and with most people who hear this story, she says, I felt like a victim of rape.
And I just want to be clear, when we say that she thought they were going to be medical residents, so she knew that there was a possibility that a doctor might provide the sample. That's what a medical resident is. She just didn't think it was going to be her doctor, right?
Yes, that's right.
Lauren, are there any laws against this, against what happened to Liz, against what Dr. Klein did?
So the Klein case has really kind of illustrated just how unprepared the legal system has been for cases like this. Laws have started to crop up, including in Indiana. So I think the earliest one is actually in California. There was some incidents of fertility fraud, which is kind of this growing term of the misuse of gametes of eggs and sperm. In California, the University of California Irvine Medical Center, it was discovered that the doctors were negligently putting embryos of the wrong women into other women. And so they passed a law that said that it was illegal to put eggs or sperm into someone without written consent, the sperm or the eggs and sperm that they had agreed to. And since then, there were two laws that came on the books this year that both had to do with these major cases of fertility fraud. Indiana's law was passed and went into effect in July. And that law said that now using your own sperm specifically, that's a low-level felony. And it also said that doctor-conceived children, that's what sort of the word is for what folks happened, the children who are a result of what Donald Klein did, women and their partners can sue the doctors who use their own sperm. And there's a longer statute of limitations on that. There's a law in Texas that goes even further and makes a doctor using their own reproductive material, their own sperm, on a patient, they make that sexual assault.
We're speaking to Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper of WFYI Public Radio in Indianapolis. They are the co-hosts of the new podcast, Sick. We'd love to hear from you, your questions about the fertility industry, or if you have had any experiences with any of the things that can go wrong or right with fertility treatment. We'd love to know what you experience. Perhaps you work in the fertility clinic industry as a doctor or dealing with patients or as a counselor to potential donors or families. What do you wish more people understood about fertility treatment that maybe they don't consider beforehand or that catches them by surprise during the process? Email us 1A@WAMU.org. Tweet us at 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Claire wrote on our Facebook page, "It's malpractice. Were they sued for malpractice? Were the doctors reported to their boards for disciplinary action?" Jake Harper, does this count as malpractice?
I think in Indiana, we're still waiting to find out. There are some medical malpractice cases related to this, but they have not made their way through. In Indiana, we have sort of a two-tiered system. They haven't even made it through the first tier last time I checked. So they haven't even gone to court yet.
So it's got to be reported, and then they kind of determine what level of law enforcement action to take? Is that the two-tier system?
Yeah, so it starts out with a group of doctors essentially looking at the case before it can go into the sort of judicial system. So a group of doctors will weigh in, decide how much money should be awarded, if any, and then if the plaintiffs want to continue on with the case, they can then go into court.
Lauren, what did Dr. Klein have to say for himself? I'm sure that this eventually came to light, and then we realized the level of how many patients that he had inseminated. What did he have to say for himself?
He hasn't really talked to the media. There have been a couple stories that have come out that he's provided comment for. Eventually, he spoke in court, and I'm pretty sure he apologized for the pain that he caused his family. But I think there's something that the siblings are really kind of troubled by. That's the self kind of proclaimed group of folks who were born after Donald Klein inseminated their mothers with his own sperm, where he hasn't really given a direct apology or taken, sort of shown that he was sorry for what he did.
And how many siblings are there?
It's growing, but right now there's over 60.
60?
Yes.
60.
Yeah, 60.
And he hasn't said really anything directly to these 5 dozen plus people?
It's complicated. He has spoken to some of them, but we go through this in further episodes of our podcast. But I think, it's definitely safe to say that most of them have not spoken directly with Klein.
What have they had to say about him? I imagine some of them would be highly ticked.
Yeah, I mean, we get mostly that. I think the other thing too is that we aren't talking with everyone. I think there are a fair number of these siblings who take DNA tests find out about the client's situation and say, you know what, I don't want to know more. I don't really want to be involved in this, and I'm gonna steer clear. And then but the ones that we've spoken to and the ones who are sort of out front in the media are clearly very angry about the situation.
We'll hear more from one of them, from Liz's son, Matt. We'll hear from him in a little bit, but you mentioned, Lauren, that he spoke in court. Whatever became of that court case?
Klein was eventually charged with obstruction of justice. Like we talked about in Indiana, up until recently, there was no law to specifically make what Klein did illegal. But as we get into it in the show, as folks were investigating what happened, he lied about his involvement. So now he's a felon in Indiana.
Some of you have shared your experiences similar to this. Joan emailed, "We thoroughly enjoyed our conversations with our doctor about the science of the procedure I had and general medical issues. The test results were fine, and we had a healthy baby girl. Imagine our shock and horror when we found he was using his own sperm in fertility treatments. Every time I saw another little curly-headed red child, it broke my heart." Jake, I don't know how many of the parents that went to Dr. Klein that you've spoken to, but I can imagine some of them probably wanted to beat him to death with their bare hands for what he did. I mean, how have the families who went to him processed this?
I mean, I think they're still processing it for the most part. I mean, I think we've spoken with I think probably four or five parents who have been in this situation. I'd say it's been harder to find dads who are willing to talk to us at all. And I think that reaction that you just described has been relayed to us from some of the fathers through their children that we spoke to. I mean, I think it's definitely a source of anger and outrage, which is why they're talking to people like us, essentially.
And Lauren, is this kind of an isolated case, or have you heard about other fertility fraud cases?
It is not an isolated case. I think one of the most prominent actually happened in your all backyard. That was back in the 90s. There was a doctor named Cecil Jacobson, who, like Klein, was sort of the go-to doctor in that area who folks who needed fresh donor insemination went to. And they found out just a little bit later that he had fathered upwards of 75 children. So that was a major case. Now there's ones that are popping up in Idaho and Vermont, Connecticut and Oregon, and really recently in Ohio as well. And also outside the U.S., there's a case in Canada and one in the Netherlands where a doctor who recently died was found to father more than 50 children.
We'll talk about the broader scope of this when we continue with Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper, the co-hosts of the new podcast Sick from WFYI. We'll get to some of the repercussions that these doctors could face, and we're honored to have heard from some of you who have dealt with this kind of deceptive practice, including one of you who says you are a patient of Dr. Klein's. We'll read Kathy's story next. Back now to our conversation with Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper, the co-hosts of the new podcast Sick from WFYI, focusing on fertility clinics. We asked you about your experiences with fertility treatment. We've gotten a tremendous amount of responses from you, including this one from Keith, who left this note in our inbox.
My name is Keith. I'm calling from Chicago. My wife and I tried in vitro fertilization about 18 years ago. It failed, but long story short, they actually mixed up samples and tried to inseminate her and did inseminate her with the wrong man's semen. It didn't catch, but then they informed us there was a chance she might get HIV from that, and we had to go through about a year and a half of screening. We dodged that bullet, but people should ask if the clinic that you're using does screen for HIV. If they don't and they mess up, you could pay that. We ended up adopting, and our daughter is now 18 years old, and we're as happy as we could be with that. Just some of the foibles of the process.
Wow. Keith, thank you very much for sharing that story with us. We heard from some of you about adoption as well, and I'll get to that in just a minute. Michael tweeted, "Our daughter Amelie turns 12 in 2 weeks. Without IVF, she would likely not exist. We are enormously grateful." Stephanie tweeted, "What folks underappreciate when flippantly regarding fertility treatment as no big deal is the total relinquishment of control a woman gives of her body, the somatic toll and trauma of handing over your genetic material." Interesting you share that, Stephanie, because Liz spoke about what it was like to have a male fertility doctor. Here's another clip from episode 1 of Sick.
At that time, there were very few female OBGYNs. It was predominantly male-dominated. And so in that position with an unknown or not very well-known doctor, because you go once every year or once every 2 years, there's that sense of, well, I hope he's not looking at my vagina in a sexual way. I remember him being friendly at the first visit with my husband. After that, it was just a procedural kind of thing.
Transactional almost?
Yes. I don't remember a conversation with Klein being anything warm or engaging or comforting. So I could trust him more. I just remember it being procedural.
Lauren, could you react to that clip? And also to the comment we read, just this feeling of having a doctor come in and meeting you at a moment of real emotional need, and then treating you like just a car that he's repairing, like it's just this item on a to-do list.
Sure. I mean, that's something that really struck me in our reporting was when Klein was graduating from medical school in the mid-60s and starting his career in the 70s, you know, most doctors were men. Most of the doctors in his med school class were men. Most OBGYNs were men, which is, I mean, strikes me as a woman who's been seeing an OBGYN for more than a decade, and I would ever only want to see a woman. And you are in this really kind of vulnerable position when you're up there. Something, you know, we've kind of tried to illustrate is this idea of you put your feet up in stirrups and there's a doctor who's standing over you, and it can feel kind of, it feels like you're putting power into someone else's hands. So when you're already in this very vulnerable position where you want to start a family and maybe you've been trying for an extended period of time, maybe this is, you know, totally changing the view of how you thought your life would go. Maybe you always, you know, pictured being pregnant or conceiving naturally, or you've, you know, thought of what a child might look like based on your characteristics and your partner's characteristics. Yeah, it's really emotional.
Can I just follow up on that, Lauren? And I'm not asking you to speak for all women, certainly, but just for those men in our audience who are just beginning to think about this for the first time, what exactly is it for a woman who sees an OBGYN that a male doctor needs to be sensitive to when treating her? I can totally understand why a woman would want to see a female OBGYN. That makes perfect sense. But in terms of men who provide that care, what are the main things, in your view, that they need to do right, do differently, do sensitively, do carefully to make sure they treat their patients properly?
Sure. Well, and we get into this in the show as well. There's this major idea of informed consent. I mean, you know, doctors go into training. They're in school for way longer than I was in school, learning how to do their jobs and do them well. And I mean, when I come into work, I just get to work and do things that I feel like are going to, you know, be best for my productivity that day. Maybe a doctor is doing the same thing, but I'm the patient who's up there in that chair. So the best thing for a doctor to do would be to talk the patient through exactly what they're doing, what the even if it's a procedure, if it's a general exam, making sure that they know, you know, here's what I'm going to be touching and here's why I'm touching it. And here's, you know, what you should know about how you can check on your own health in the future. It doesn't help to hurt to have warm hands either.
Lorraine tweeted, "Fertility medicine has been the Wild West since its inception. Only now is the law trying to catch up. Egregious acts such as doctors using their own sperm aside, very little information is collected on success rates and complications, both physical and emotional." Jake Harper, what about that? Is it still a little bit of the Wild West? I mean, how does the industry today compare to what it was in the 70s and 80s when Dr. Klein was working?
So, I mean, the technology has just changed drastically since Klein was practicing in the 70s and 80s, and you know, throughout his career, it continued to change. The first IVF in the United States, in vitro fertilization, was in 1981, I believe, and it wasn't widely available for several years after that. And it's been growing and being perfected over the years. Not that it's perfect now, but it has advanced a lot. I think the success rates, when you look at them overall, with the caveat, we're talking about assisted reproductive technologies according to the CDC definition, which is basically any time an egg or sperm or embryo is sort of used outside of the is taken outside of the body and then implanted back into a woman. When you look at all of the number of times that that process is started, it's really only about 1 in 5 women will end up having a baby at the end of that. One in five procedures is successful, which is not a great success rate when you're looking at it overall. But you look at if you Google those things, you'll find success rates that are reported around 40%, and you have to do a little digging, but you'll find that that's maybe for women under the age of 35 who have made it to the retrieval stage or something like that. So it's really hard to sort of parse out what is success in the world of IVF.
The retrieval stage?
So when you're going through IVF, there's a surgical procedure. So a woman will take drugs for a couple weeks to try to develop more eggs. And then they'll go in surgically and retrieve those eggs. So in some cases, when success rates are reported by clinics, they will report at that phase. Or maybe they'll only give like a specific age group, which would typically be a younger age group, because they'll have a higher success rate.
With regards to that Wild West part of the comment, Lauren, I wonder how you see that. I mean, there's a show called Jane the Virgin, which was on the CW. Now it's on Netflix, which centers around this accidental artificial insemination of a woman named Jane who has never been sexually active at the time she's inseminated. It's a comedy, kind of in the style of a telenovela, meant to be dramatic. But given some of these crazy stories, Lauren, it doesn't seem far off. But how do you see the perception of this industry versus the reality?
It's interesting, and I mean, I've never seen Jane the Virgin. I've been recommended many times. But I mean, that procedure, so a procedure of artificial insemination or IUI, intrauterine insemination, where sperm is injected directly into the uterus, the CDC doesn't track that. That's not considered assisted reproductive technology or an ART procedure. So the CDC collects some data. They look at success rates, and they have clinics send them to them in a way that's standardized so you can compare clinic to clinic. But yeah, then even the CDC says, but don't compare clinic to clinic, because you don't know what the patients look like at that clinic. A clinic might be much more willing to accept women who are a little bit older, who, you know, the older you get, the less likely your pregnancy success rates are, and also the more likely that any embryos that are made, the sperm and egg come together to make an embryo, the more likely they might be chromosomally abnormal. And so then maybe you wouldn't want to implant those if you think that that could lead to a complication with the child. So I guess when it comes to kind of the Wild West, some of what people talk about more than procedures even is the regulation of sperm banks, because that's something that's really kind of different in the U.S. where there's oversight, where the banks themselves will have, you know, standards that they say that they adhere to.
Right.
The federal government makes you test for certain diseases, but a lot of it is just sort of self-regulated.
Let me get to a few more of your stories. Kathy emailed, "I was a patient of Dr. Klein's. He was dishonest with me because he did not use a donor for medical school. We have learned that my son was conceived from a sperm bank in California and has over a dozen siblings. It has been a disturbing and violating experience for me personally and also for my son." We also heard from a number of you who had very positive experiences. Danielle tweeted, "Tremendously grateful for IVF, which allowed us to have our now 11-week-old son when years of trying on our own failed. The doctors and nurses were unendingly careful, patient, and kind, and made the process much more tolerable than I had anticipated." Congratulations, Danielle. And Ben emailed, "I was conceived by my mother through IVF because my father was infertile. Through the website 23andMe, I was able to find a number of half-siblings. One of them, a half-sister, found a questionnaire the donor filled out and a 6-minute-long audio interview. It was very informative and something of a miracle to find these people I'm related to, along with info on my donor father." I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Lauren, what about the way that fertility specialists are certified or accredited today? Is there any way for patients to know they're getting good care?
I mean, fertility specialists are doctors, so they have to go through the same training and licensing that any other doctor would have to go through. And there are clinics who join professional societies. The Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology, or SART, will certify clinics. The CDC had to come up with ways that labs that handle embryos also have to be certified. That's voluntary. So they may or may not do that. But the CDC says that they do have a pretty high compliance rate. So if you do some looking online, you'd be able to find out clinics that do comply with these regulations that are imposed sort of by the field itself.
Victoria tweeted, "One thing I wish people would understand about infertility is that no one prepares you for not being able to become pregnant or what happens when assisted reproduction takes a long time or doesn't work. The movies make it seem like it will work immediately." Jake, from your reporting, what are some of the other things that you think people should keep in mind, some of the questions they should ask, some of the challenges they should prepare for if they're considering the IUI or IVF?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about pop culture and showing people that this technology works does sort of have a double-edged sword. I mean, I came into this reporting thinking that success rates were much higher than they actually are. Like I said before, when you look at the number of cycles that are started, the number of IVF cycles that are started, only 1 in 5, a little bit more than 1 in 5 results in a live birth. And I think the other thing that people need to be aware of is that I think only 16 states mandate some sort of either coverage or that insurers offer coverage for fertility treatment. And that means that a lot of these treatments are going to be coming out of your own pocket. And even if you have insurance, some people we spoke with said that the medications that they were on weren't necessarily covered, and if you have to go to using a sperm donor or an egg donor, those things aren't always covered either, and those are really expensive. And so, I mean, understanding the costs, understand the likelihood of success, and I think the other thing too is with insurance. I mean, as much as you can say about insurance companies, one thing that they do is that they evaluate treatments because they don't want to pay for things that don't work.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we've talked to a number of experts about is sort of these add-on technologies that can be offered to you as a patient by your doctor or by your clinic. And they don't necessarily have what scientists would consider rigorous evidence behind them.
You mentioned insurance. Janet emailed, "Back in 1989, a lot of fertility treatments were newer, not very successful, and not covered by insurance. My husband and I tried some pills and insemination. After not succeeding, we knew we only had money for one in vitro treatment or adoption. We decided on adoption twice and have never regretted it. After you mourn that dream and move on, it's a great way to create a family. Our sons are our sons." One more voicemail before we go. Here's what Rose left in our inbox.
My name is Rose Heller, and me and my husband had a baby with a local in vitro fertilization company 2 years ago about. And they promised that it would be an easy, carefree, affordable process because I was young and I just had my tubes tied. It was a complete nightmare, and I felt like the customer service wasn't 100% on par. But we have a healthy, happy, thriving baby, and I feel like that industry sometimes plays on the desires of couples and women's hope to want a baby when they're salespeople, so you just have to take the good with the bad sometimes.
Rose, thank you very much for sharing your story, and thank you, Lauren and Jake, for sharing this very powerful story with us. Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper, health reporters for Side Effects News and the co-hosts of the podcast Sick from WFYI in Indianapolis. The first episode is out now. Lauren, Jake, thanks for talking to us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks.
We'd also be honored if you check out our podcast on the NPR One app or any app that you use to get podcasts. And please do write us a review. You'll find all the links to listen at npr.org/1A. And do send us your questions for Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke. Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink. To learn about our team, visit the1A.org. And this program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.